Hello again, everybody. It's Joe Pernesti on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio, in their own words. And as always, I want to give a special shout out to Bobby Halton, Chief Editor-in-Chief of Fire Engineering, and Pete Prochillo, the webpage editor at Fire Engineering, for allowing me and giving you this, giving me the opportunity to bring to you, the listener, the authors of articles in both Fire Engineering and Firefighter Nation. And today we are talking to with Stephen Solkoff, who wrote an article. It was in beginning of June, June 1st of 2021 in Firefighter Nation. It's called The Young Volunteer Fire Officer. And you need to fully understand your strengths and weaknesses, he says, before you ride in the seat. And Steve, I want to welcome you. If you would, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Joe, thank you. Thank you for having me. My name is Stephen Solkoff. I'm a second-generation firefighter in Northeast New Jersey, a volunteer firefighter. I did some career work during college down south in Kentucky. I spent 4 years down there, and I worked per diem for a department here in Central Jersey as a firefighter about four times a month. I'm 32 years old. I have a bachelor's degree in fire and safety engineering, concentrating in fire protection administration. And my master's is in public administration in fire and emergency services. So I have, I've given my my entire adult life to the trade and to understanding and to becoming a better leader and understanding why it's important to be a better leader. So I'm very happy to be here, very happy to share my experiences and what I've learned throughout my short-lived time in the career. I'm only 32, so I became an officer when I was 23 or 24. So speaking about young volunteer fire officers, I think I hit the nail on the head there, Joe.
Yeah, you did. And so, you know, for full disclosure, and our listeners that have listened to my podcast in the past know that I'm from an urban, old school Rust Belt Fire Department in Northern Ohio, the city of Elyria. And I am full time and have only worked in the full time sector. However, surrounding my community, and I have many friends that are in the volunteer and part time departments. And so, and I follow what's happening in the fire service quite intently. And I know that there is a strong need for, you know, volunteer and part-time firefighters. There's always a need for people to step up and to serve their communities. But along with that, there's also the same reason why that's happening is there's just so much going on in people's lives today compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago that people don't have the same amount of time to invest. And when they do get on, they're running into this problem of what you describe in your article, that, you know, you're getting put into an officer position young in a volunteer or part-time department, and you need a survival. And this is the first article that I have found that is geared strictly for that. So that's a good thing. But tell us why, you know, you mentioned your experience, but, and you mentioned that you're 32 and you started out young, but what were some of the experiences that led you to want to put it to pen? You know, the need to write about this subject and to help out young officers.
Joe, it's a great question. And I think not only for young officers, but officers at any age, when they get into their fire service leadership career, they're going to identify strengths and weaknesses of their own personal strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, and I shot up through the ranks. So from when I first got promoted to when I became the chief of department, it was only 8 years. And in the volunteer fire service, that's not uncommon. And That's one of the weaknesses that we have in the volunteer fire service, is that turnover of officers and the speed at which you promote is astronomical compared to the professional fire service or the career fire service. So I felt it important to get this down on paper and to share my experiences, because I can't be the only person having these issues, and I can't be the only person who's experiencing some of these feelings. I'm a big advocate for mental health. And that started when I, you know, became a leader in the fire service, because I understood, I started to learn and understand the trials and tribulations that were associated with, you know, the fire service leadership. And the easiest part about being the fire chief, Joe, is going to fires. Yeah. It's the the mentalities, the personalities, the ideologies that we have in the firehouses that, you know, are trivial and that are strugglesome to the membership. So, you know, I felt it important because I knew I wasn't the only person dealing with it. And I felt it very important to get it down on paper for the people to read.
And as we get into the article, I guess my question that I have for you is, what would you say is the number one issue then? Okay, so take away the firefighting and a tactical, you know, tactics and strategy aspect. But what would you say then is the number one issue or concern in the volunteer fire service then when it comes to this specific officer ranks?
Sure. You know, it's age. I mean, the number one concern in the fire service, especially in the state of New Jersey where I'm from, is the age of the membership. There's a huge gap between there's 18 to 30. There's a huge gap and there's 45 and up, you know, so that generational shift and that generational disconnect is huge. And, you know, I'm ultimately responsible for leading people who are military veterans who have gone to war, you know, and people who have been in the military understand command presence, they understand leadership and to respect it. But, you know, when you don't align yourself with what their beliefs may be, they can become troublesome to you and they can be one of the hurdles that you have to overcome. So understanding that, you know, there's a huge age difference, and in those age differences, people operate and learn differently is one of the biggest things I think we can take away from this.
You mentioned in the article that your very first day in the front seat, there was a May Day.
Yep.
Tell our listeners that maybe haven't read the article, you know, a little bit about what took place and the lessons that obviously you've learned and wanted to share today.
So, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, on my I was promoted on the first, and on the second we turned out for a report of a fire. You know, as we pulled out of the firehouse, I was the first one on the road, the first company on the road. And the fire was two blocks from the house. So I knew it was a job. I could see the column. The column was, you know, pushing heavily. Dispatch was getting multiple calls. We show up first due. There's 1,000 people in what I feel was 1,000 people on the front lawn when in reality it was probably 10. You know, and, you know, I'm telling myself the whole way there, you know, I've transmitted a working fire. I've asked for more help. I've done all the steps that I know I have to do. When I get on scene, I'm going to do a 360. Don't panic, don't freeze. And that was what I kept telling myself on the way to the job. And, you know, now when I go to fires, I talk about a lot more things with my crew. I'm more comfortable and more confident. But pulling up to that fire, I had done my 360. I get to the front door and I see one of those, you know, chairs that go up and down the stairs for less than ambulatory people, helps them up and down the stairs. That was in the upper position. So to me, that house was occupied. Nobody on the front lawn could tell me who lived there. Nobody could tell me if everybody was out of the home. So I had my crew start to initiate a search, and that search was in front of the engine. And in the volunteer fire service, you know, it's not looked down upon, but it's not a common practice to not have your first piece of apparatus not have water on it. So, you know, as we started doing the search, it was a Collier's mansion or a clutter type home. And they got up there, they got up to the second floor, became disoriented, and they transmitted a mayday, and everything stopped for me. It was the most stressful 30 seconds of my life. We were ahead of the engine. We had no water. We had no RIT team established. You know, what are people going to think about me? What are people going to, and I was really worried about myself, as well as my crew, but how are people going to react to this? What if I lose four firefighters in my first 5 minutes as a fire officer? What is going to happen? And it took a lot for me. It took a lot of personal and mental growth to overcome that day. And there's not a day that I don't think about that fire on Fifth Street. There's not a day that I don't think about those members that I sent in there. And, you know, it wasn't, I'm not gonna say it was a nothing May Day, but the May Day was cleared. They came out of the home, they went back to work and everything was fine. But for 30 seconds there, I didn't know what to think. And I had 1,000 different ideas going through my head of what's about to happen. So it's a very trying time. And if you're ever in charge of a fire where a May Day comes out, you're going to think about that day for the rest of your life.
Well, And back to what you were worried about, you know, what people were thinking or saying or finger pointing. How did you handle that? How long did it take for you to, you know, like maybe move on or to get, you know, the lessons and then move forward?
So I think when the department critiqued the fire is when I really had, you know, come to realization that I had made a decision, and I speak about it in the article. I've made a decision and I stand by my decision. You know, there was a lot of finger pointing. There was a lot of yelling at that critique, which is unhealthy within itself. Sure. But that was the time when I said, you know, something, I support what I did. I respect what I did. You know, I didn't have information that I would love to have had, but the fire service is inherently dangerous and we're in a risky business. So, you know, we have to take risks. We have to get comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. And that's when it happened. I think during that critique, we had a long critique of this fire. And that's when I came to realize that, you know, you've made a decision, you've done something. The outcome wasn't the best of what you wanted it to be, but you've made a decision. And as long as you can make a decision and stick by your guns and have reason to why you've made that decision, you're going to do just fine.
Yeah. And I think that goes for really any size fire department, or, you know, again, it doesn't matter, you know, part-time, full-time, 1,000 firefighters or 10, that I think firefighters want leaders and bosses to make a decision. You know, the biggest problem that I see is the officers that always had the toughest time were those that were very indecisive, or, you know, could not make a decision. But in the article, you mentioned some bullet points that I kind of want you to go over and maybe get into a little deeper here, that you say that to combat the struggle of emotions, personalities, and ideas, remember a few things, and a couple of them, you know, no two people are the same. In volunteer and part-time organizations, what do you specifically mean by that? Are you talking age-wise, they're not the same? What are you trying to get at there with that bullet point, Steve?
So certainly age is one of the factors, but when I say that no two people are the same, I mean that, you know, ability levels are not the same. You know, I speak about building the well-rounded fire company and understanding, you know, what your company's strengths and weaknesses are. No two people are the same. So what I expect of Jim, you know, I could have similar expectations of John, but I may not get the same result.
Yeah.
Furthermore, when I say that no two people are the same, how they deal with conflict has striking differences. You know, do they point fingers, yell and scream? Do they talk about you behind your back? Do they talk about you to your face? You know, understanding the differences and how people react differently to different things is important to understand when you're dealing with these emotions and personalities.
And the one that's always the same, the 33, the rule of 33s.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead and give our listeners what the rule of 33s are.
The rule of 33, and even though it's not perfect math, 33% love you, 33% hate you, and 33% just don't care what you do. And that's especially in the volunteer fire service. 33% of those guys and girls are going to be, you know, they're going to have your back. They're going to appreciate what you bring to the table. They're going to help you to build yourself as a better fire officer. They're going to help you to help build the department as an organization. 33% just don't like you. They will find everything under the sun to pick at, to nitpick at. They'll find everything that you did wrong. 1,000 things could go right, but if that one thing goes wrong, they're going to tell you about it. You know, 33% just don't care. They kind of go with the flow. Okay, you're the boss. This is what we'll do. Okay, I got it. You know, and it's important to understand that you have groups of people and how those groups of people react to your actions as an officer. It's important to understand that.
In a part-time department, when you have that, you know, there is it a little harder to get through those that may not like you? Because it seems to me that it could be troubling that when you tell somebody what to do, there's always that fear of, well, I'll just quit or I'll just leave. How do you combat that? How do you handle that?
And that's a great point. I really don't think that's just in the volunteer or part-time fire service. You know, I think that's the reality everywhere. And, you know, to me, I was always brought up that the fire service is a business, you know, and in my personal life, I work for the Port Authority in New York, New Jersey. I work for the government. So I have an understanding that you are my supervisor. I may not care about everything. I'm not care for everything that you do, but you are my supervisor, you know, and if in the fire service, if you don't like something that I've told you and you're just going to up and quit, maybe you weren't cut out for the fire service to begin with. Yeah. But before that happens, you know, I believe in exit interviews. You know, I want out. Okay, let's talk about why you want out. You can go. You can go. But let's talk about why you want to go. And maybe I can use that time to kind of bring you back in and understand what your concerns are to kind of alter my way of operating.
Yeah, it's an important point that you know, it is very difficult. You're not going to get everybody to love you. We know that. But it seems to be that the younger you are in that position, in an officer position, you know, you are dealing with guys that are maybe twice your age, and that, you know, a younger person probably needs a mentor or somebody that they can bounce advice off of, whether it's full-time or in that part-time sector, you know, the senior man, if you will, to rely on them. And to leadership is about personalities really more than anything, a lot of times, in handling communications and relationships. And I think that is some good points that you make, leading into don't argue and don't, the tensions may run high, calm down. We'll talk about it when we get home. You tell our listeners a little bit, you know, you mentioned your experience, but you know, tensions run high. What do you tell that young officer? How do you calm everybody down? How do you just say, calm down, we'll handle it when we get back?
So I don't personally like the term calm down. Sure. You know, that's just me. Yeah. I always joke that I was never calmed up. So
yeah, it does get people fired up when you go calm down or relax. That's the word. Yeah, that's the word I hate. Relax.
Absolutely. But, and you know, just to bounce off real quick, Joe, what you were saying before about, you know, people having 20, 30 years on me, the firehouse that I turn out of right now, I grew up in. My father was a fireman there for 30 something years. So a lot of these guys that report to me, I've known since I was 5, 6, 7 years old.
Yeah.
So that adds a level of discomfort for some of them, for sure. You know, but as far as tensions running high at emergencies and talking about it when you get home, you know, I approach that as, you know, okay, I understand that you have a concern, but let's take it somewhere else. I understand that you're nervous or worried about this, but let's address it at another time. Accepting and telling the member that you accept that they have a concern is going to let them hold on to that and say, all right, the captain's willing to listen to what I have to say. He doesn't want me to talk about it here, but you better believe I'm going to talk about it when we get home. We can yell, holler, and scream. And I hate to say it that way, but they can yell, holler, and scream when we get back to the firehouse. We're out of the public's eye, and that's where the situations need to be solved. And, you know, I would rather see it in the firehouse amongst the membership where we can talk to one another as men or as women instead of in front of a neighbor or some, or a, you know, a customer of ours. Because, you know, when they see us arguing and disagreeing on the fire ground, they've called us on their worst day. So if we're going to go into disagreement on the fire ground, you know, they're going to say, I called these people for help and they can't even get along with one another. So identifying and saying, yes, you have an issue, I am going to address it, we are going to talk about it, gives them that reaffirmation. And that all goes back to how you handle yourself at all times. You know, if I have a member who doesn't entrust in me that, yes, the captain will address my concerns or will discuss my concerns with me at a company meeting, how are they supposed to accept it on the fire ground? So that's just your character. That's what drives you at all times, not just on the fire ground.
So moving forward here, you know, I want to talk a little bit about traits of a good fire officer. And you had mentioned that, I think I'll paraphrase a little bit that because it's so true and it's helped me in my career is that, you know, look at both good and bad leaders and then identify what you liked and disliked. And sometimes you can learn, you can become a better leader by learning from some real bad ones, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
you know, what are your thoughts and what are some of your experiences when it comes to that? Because I do say that I find myself repeating that a lot now to the younger members of my department, that it, you know, look at good and bad and pick what you like.
Absolutely. And what I find good, you may not find good. And what I find bad, you may not find bad. So, you know, understand that there's a line there, a floating line that we have to become equal to. You know, one of my favorite TV shows is Band of Brothers. Yeah. And when you read about Dick Winters at Easy Company and the Band of Brothers, you learn that their first CEO, their first commanding officer, nobody liked. But if you read his book, Dick Winters portrays that because of what Captain Sobel did, built them as a company and built them as leaders themselves. So, you know, not only will bad traits, or let me rephrase that, bad traits can be good to good leaders at times.
Yeah.
Understanding bad traits can be good to good leaders because it's not what you want to do. And let's face it, we're all human. We all make mistakes.
Right.
And we all will make mistakes and continue to make mistakes. It's how we come back from those mistakes and how we answer those futile questions that'll determine what makes us good leaders.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm paraphrasing here, but Winston Churchill said that failure is not fatal, right? And failure is not final, but it's how you react to that will drive what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Or if you run from it, that's even worse. As a leader, right. You just run away, you know, what is a sensible decision maker? What do you mean by that when you describe that in your article? And what is, I love it. Another great, and really, I sometimes, when I go and reach out through Fire Engineering and Firefighter Nation to get the contacts of those that have written articles, sometimes it's like a quote or something they'll put in there. And what grabbed me was one of the big ones that grabbed me was that you talk about spaghetti leaders. Let's talk a little bit about this sensible decision maker and what the heck is a spaghetti leader.
So, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up. You know, being a sensible decision maker, you know, you're not making change just for the sense of making, just for the sake of making change. You know, there's two things that all firefighters hate: change and the way things are.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. You know, when you look at your company and you look at your department and you want to make a change, you have to weigh everything, the good, the bad, financial aspects of that, you know, and weighing everything. And, you know, we don't want to just make a change for the sake of it. So when I talk about being a spaghetti leader, the old adage is that one of the ways to know if spaghetti is done is to just take it out and throw it on the wall and see if it sticks. You know, so, you know, you don't want to be the guy who comes up with, concocts all these ideas, throws them all out there and sees which one works best. You want to have some type of decision-making process. And, you know, is the first decision that you've made going to be the way to go? Maybe not, but you need to be able to set that into motion, to evaluate it, to see what the pros and the cons of it are, and either A, accept it and carry on with it, or B, make necessary changes that are effective to your organization. So, you know, in the sense of sensible decision making, you really want to think hard and think long before putting anything into action. And that's the importance of that there.
And what I find hard about that today is that a leader, you know, like and my dad too was on. You and I are following, and you know, it's same thing, because I again started. I was 19 years old, became a lieutenant on my fire department when I was 24, and my dad was on the job in the same city for 30 some years. So all those things, it's the same thing. The same, our paths are identical. But one thing I found when I was a brand new lieutenant in the early 90s, mid 90s, was that, you know, things weren't as fast paced. It seems like things are a little bit more, people are more impatient. They want answers. And so sometimes that indecisiveness, or like you're saying, you know, think about things before you come out with it. There could be a lot of pressure put on you, I find. And I find it in my own career that, you know, come on, make this decision. Let's go. Compared to yesteryear. I don't know if you feel that way or, you know, being, you know, a younger member of the department, if that's the way it is with today's firefighters, because everything's so quick and so fast.
I think, Joe, that, you know, especially with the onset of social media, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people get their information from the internet, and they get a lot of their information from unreviewed peer journals and videos and YouTube and things like that. And, you know, when that happens, they take that for gold. And I said all the time as a fire chief, it's not gold and it's not gospel. I'm also a firm believer that things that we do is a way, not the way. You know, I'm right outside New York City, so everybody has FDNY on the mind. Like if you're in Northern Virginia or if you're out in Chicago, you know, a lot of things tailored to those major urban departments that go to a lot of fires, that get a lot of notoriety. And just because it works for them doesn't mean that it works for you. You know, so I think with the onset of social media and YouTube and things like that, you know, people are valuing what they see and saying, this is what we have to do. Look, FDNY does it. Look, Miami does it. Look, Chicago does it. And that might not be the best approach for things. So slowing down and asking questions. I have a boss at work in my full-time job. You know, when we go out to do an investigation, he asks questions and questions and questions of what you think might be a 1, 2, 3 in and out job. No, he's got 1, 2, 3 through 250, you know. It really slows down. It really helps you to understand. Because if we can't speak to why we're doing what we're doing, then we're failing ourselves. We're failing our fellow members. We're failing our customers and our community.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. And you know, let's go on to how best. We talked a little bit about senior members. And is there any difference in how a part-time department utilizes their senior members to maybe like a full-time department that you are with the senior member 24/7. What are some of the differences in a part-time department and how best to utilize that senior member? Because you do mention that, you know, everybody in your area, FDNY, and you know what, firefighting is local. Chief Halton has said that many times, and it's one thing that I truly believe in. Fire, you got to do you. You do you in your department. What are some of the things that you would say would be different or what advice as far as using that senior man?
So it's tough in the volunteer and part-time fire service to have a true senior man as they have in, let's say, the FDNY, the senior man on the company. You know, do we have senior men who have spent 30 years inside that firehouse? Absolutely. But, you know, when we get a job, we get a run, that doesn't mean that they're going to be turning out every time that I do. So I like to see the senior man more as a mentorship program, finding somebody that you appreciate, finding somebody that you can relate with, who can communicate well with you. Because there are going to be people in your firehouse who have 30, 25, 30 years on the job or in the department who just don't know how to act with somebody younger. They don't have children. They don't remember the last time they took some type of class or some type of formal education. So they don't understand the new methodologies of instruction, you know? So, but building a mentorship program, I think, is the best way to utilize the more seasoned people in that firehouse. And it doesn't have to be the senior person, especially in the volunteer fire service. You know, you're going to see senior people who call themselves senior people who are 75 years old, have 55 years in the firehouse, but haven't rode a truck in 22 of them. Yeah. So, you know, identifying who a good mentor is that will help you build yourself as a firefighter. And let's face it, when we come into the firehouse, you know, everybody says, you know, you have one chance to make a first impression. Well, that goes both ways. If I walk into your firehouse, you know, the people who are already there are making an impression on me and I'm making an impression on them. So once I determine, you know, who I want to, you know, who I want to visualize myself with, that's when that mentorship program, regardless if it is the true senior man or just a seasoned person in the firehouse, that's where that mentorship program becomes very valuable.
Explain to our listeners the abrasive bastard.
So the abrasive bastard actually came from my mentor. And, you know, Chief Farr, Jim, he was a professor of mine in college. So he had already been out of the fire service. And he was somebody that I really looked up to. And, you know, as a person, as a professor, as a fire service leader, he was very well-rounded. And he is someone that I continue to speak to on a weekly basis. You know, he spoke at my wedding. He really truly is a mentor of mine. And Jim's from North Carolina. And one day when I was, you know, driving home from vacation down in Kentucky, I was a newly appointed fire chief. And I was thinking about, I said, you know, this is nothing like what Jim said this was going to be like. You know, he said that we were going to go to fires and we were going to do this. He didn't talk about budgets. He didn't talk about dealing with local government. He didn't talk about, you know, strengths and weaknesses and things like that. And I called him and I said, I said to him, Jim, you let me down. He just laughed at me. And I said, great. You know, I'm calling him for advice and he's laughing at me. You know, so long or the short, you know, he said to me, he goes, you know, when you buy an axe in the hardware store, is that axe ready to go cut down trees, chop wood, and do whatever an axe is supposed to do? And, you know, I said, probably not. He said, of course not. He goes, but the axe is on the fire truck. They're ready to chop wood. They're ready to open up roofs. He goes, why is that? And I said, well, because, you know, we have cleaning details and house details and equipment maintenance. He goes, right. He goes, it's been, and they've been used before. He goes, you know, those tools have been honed to do the job that they have to do. And they've been modified and ultimately, you know, fabricated and refabricated to do the job that they have to do. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, Jim, you know, what are you talking about? You know, and of course he laughs at me again. You know, he said that an axe that is purchased at the store needs to be honed to do the job that it has to do. It is not ready right out of the gate to do work. He said, and you know how you sharpen an axe? I said, no, because I'm from the city. I have no clue. You know, I use a, you know, a grinder. He goes, a file, a bastard file. And I said, okay, Jim, what are you getting at, man? And it's starting to click to me. He goes, you know, sometimes to hone something to do the job it has to do, you need that abrasive bastard to kind of lead your way. And so when I speak about the abrasive bastard, I think about the older people in the fire service who have been there much longer than me, who at first I thought just wanted to see me fail.
Sure.
And really just there to help to see me succeed. And they're kind of guiding me and leading me and being pretty abrasive and sometimes aggressive, you know, to hone me into the fire service leader that they want to see, that can do the job. So that's what the abrasive bastard is about. It's about that, that abrasive person who you might think is your arch enemy, who does not want to see you succeed. They're in that 33% of I hate you, but they're really there to help to hone you into the man or to the person that you need to become.
Absolutely. And they don't even know it a lot of times.
Nope.
They don't even know it that they're doing that.
Nope, not at all.
And so that's a good thing. As we start to wind things down, I want to talk a little bit about firefighting now, the actual tactics and those things. That what advice, again, someone listening to this is in your position, or, you know, as a new, or at one time you were in that young officer. I imagine it's tougher in a part-time and volunteer service to sit somebody down and tell them that, you know, you need to improve on this tactic, or, you know, stretching lines, or your, you know, search, or your breathing air, or your overall physical fitness. It's tough in the full-time side with, you know, unions and contracts and those things. What's it like in your world there, and how do you handle it, and what advice you give on something like that?
You know, Joe, a lot of times people don't want to hear that they are a problem or that they have an issue that they need to work on. And, you know, that can be very trying. So what I like to do when I come across that is to sometimes take myself out of it, because a lot of times it's harder to accept that the boss is coming down on you than that your peers are coming down on you. So I make, you know, either whether it's with the mentorship program, I might go to that person's mentor and say, hey, you know, I see Knicks having a problem with ladder placement or with apparatus positioning, you know. And granted, when the job comes in and it's time to work, I'm responsible for the integrity of that crew, and I'm going to do my job and make the corrections that are necessary. But, you know, sometimes I like to remove myself from that and speak to the senior members that I entrust and that I can, that I respect, and say, you know, I see that Mark is having trouble with ropes and knots. You know, you, sir, are a good, you're on a regional rope team. I speak about that. You know, you're on a regional rope team. Can you kind of sit down with him and see where the problem is and what we can do to try and correct it? Is it because he needs one-on-one assistance, but he's ashamed to come to me because I'm the boss? That's a very good possibility. So a lot of times I like to remove myself from that situation, but there are times where I have to get involved, and, you know, there's a fine line between being sensible and being hard on somebody, and understanding how that person reacts mentally and emotionally to things is important to how you're going to approach the issue. Are you going to approach it with kid gloves, like we say, or are you going to approach it, you know, aggressively and point your finger and say, you didn't do this, you're messing up on searches, you missed the whole room? That's not probably the most effective form of communication when it comes to corrective action.
Well put. If there's a piece of literature or book or something that you would like to recommend to anybody listening, what are some of the books that you would read or read it that they could be on anything, but any suggestions that you would like to pass on?
So, you know, I speak a lot about mental toughness, and I speak a lot about emotional integrity. And there is a book, and I promise you this is the title, so I apologize, but it's called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. It is an amazing book about how to overcome, you know, mental toughness, how to maintain your mental fortitude, and how to really deal with emotions and problems that you're having. So that's one of them. And another one that I highly recommend, and I spoke about it a little bit earlier, it's a book called Beyond the Band of Brothers. It's the memoirs of Dick Winters, the captain or the major of Easy Company, the commanding officer. And, you know, he really talks about leadership and leadership under fire and how he overcame a lot of the struggles that him and his unit were seeing. And, you know, identifying who was good at what, you know, really helped him to build the best company that he could have. And, you know, I speak about that too, identifying who the best people are to do certain tactics is imperative. But Beyond the Band of Brothers with Dick Winters, his memoirs, phenomenal read.
Steve, wonderful talking to you today. Again, the article that we're discussing is The Young Volunteer Fire Officer, appeared in beginning of June 2021 in Firefighter Nation. So search that out and give it a read, print it out, and post it. Steve, if someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you if they have further questions or want some mentoring themselves, if they're so inclined?
Joe, I think through social media is the best route for me. Steven Solcov, Sulcov. They can send me a message. You know, I do this because I love people. I love the fire service, and I have a passion for everybody, you know. So to me, you know, I am an open book, and I welcome any questions that people may have.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Joe, thanks for having me.